It's really a pleasure to be here at the Center of American Theosophy to tell you about the work that's been my passion really for my whole life. As Sharon said, I had early experiences with the American Theosophical Society in New York, where I was very fortunate to work with Dora Kunz, the brilliant, talented psychic president of the society, and she allowed me to hide magnets around her office. And she would then be able to find them psychically by being able to see the magnetic field plus or minus with her psychic sensibility. And she gave me invitations to the English Society for Psychical Research, where I met many, many friends and spent a half a year enjoying the hospitality of the English Society at Camberley. Then I came back and began honest work. I spent 25 years in doing laser work before the 15 years that I spent at Stanford investigating psychic abilities. Today I'm going to tell you about the spiritual implications of psychic ability as understood by a Buddhist, which is similar but not identical to your take on that. We'll see if we have some agreement. I'm going to tell you about the work we did at Stanford Research Institute, doing remote viewing, looking into the distance, looking into the future. And then I'm going to lead you into a experience where I will say, I don't want to make mental noise. I have an object with me, and I will guide you to experience what that object is. So I'm going to first tell you really how I got into this. At Stanford, the things that attracted the government, the CIA, and the management is that we had learned from Ingo Swann, who's a great psychic, natural psychic, we had learned that you can quiet your mind and describe and experience what's happening in the distance and what's happening in the future. And in the course of a decade, we found that people could describe what the Russians are doing in Semipalatinsk, where they had a giant crane and an underground project. We found an American general who was kidnapped in Padua, Italy. We helped the Air Force find a downed Russian bomber in Africa that was full of code books. One of the exciting things that we took part in is looking for Patricia Hearst in 1974 when she was kidnapped from her dormitory room at Berkeley. We were working with a very psychic policeman named Pat Price, and the Berkeley Police Department called on us and said, could you help us find the heiress, help us find Patricia Hearst? So we drove to Berkeley, and walked into the police station, and police there said, we're happy to see you. We've got a lot of questions we want to ask you. Pat Price said, why don't you just give me the mug book, which is the big picture book with all the usual suspects, big loose leaf binder. So he stood at a mahogany table and turned the pages, four pictures to a page, and put his finger on one guy and said, that's the ringleader. And he put his finger on the picture of Donald DeVries, who indeed turned out to be the ringleader. And the police said, yes, we know that guy. He walked away, that is, escaped from Folsom Prison a year ago, and we haven't heard from him. Can you tell us something that would be helpful? He said, would you like to know where the kidnap car is? He said, yes, we'd very much like to know that. He said, well, if you drive north on the Bayshore Freeway, Highway 101, about 50 miles north of here, on the right side of the road, there's a white station wagon by a diner, and across the street from that are two large white gas storage tanks. And one of the detectives said, well, I know where that is. That's on the way to my home in Vallejo. So they dispatched a police car. 10 minutes later, they said, I think we've got the car, because it has the same cartridges rolling around on the floorboards that we had seen 2 hours before under the bed in the house of Patricia Hearst. So that's as close to magic as I've ever seen. We just walked into the police station. We didn't know any of the people. Nobody knew where the kidnap car was. Pat Price, the psychic policeman, could just close his eyes and say they went that way, as they say in the movies, and describe the car and tell exactly where it was. And we did that kind of activity with Price for a number of years. The most striking one, I'll show you slides. I've just been interviewing the CIA contract monitors who oversaw our exploits. So I finally have on film an affidavit from the two CIA men saying, yes, these things really did happen. We signed the documents. This was a case where the CIA said, you've got to tell us something that we don't know. Of course, when you do that, they can't verify it, but we didn't realize that at the moment. And they gave us geographical coordinates of something in Russia. And Pat Price said, I see a giant crane. I'm lying on top of a building, and this crane is rolling back and forth over my body. And he drew a perfectly clear picture of an eight-wheel gantry crane. And we then went down to our vault, and they unrolled a big aerial photograph, and indeed there was a giant gantry crane. And the CIA guy said, well, it looks like you're looking at the right spot. Can you tell us what they're doing there? So we went back into our little shielded room, and Price said, well, I'm drifting into a big underground building, and they're making giant spheres. They're making a sphere 60 feet in diameter out of thick gores, that is, orange peel slices, and they're trying to weld them together. But that was underground, so nobody knew about it. Following year, Pat Price died while working for the CIA. And the year after that, the Russians opened up this building, satellite photography showed the gores, and the first anyone in the Western world knew about 60-foot diameter gores being used to build spheres is when Aviation Week published it. So it took us 2 years to get feedback. The psychic died, and we were very amazed to see that he described in the same words. He said 60-foot diameter gores used to make steel spheres, and those are the words that appeared in Aviation Week. So we decided, and the CIA decided, that this is probably a useful ability, and they supported and the CIA supported us from 1972 to 1995. So it's the one of the longest continuous supports that I've ever heard about as a scientist doing work for the government. Now, the government is very happy about this activity. We're finding airplanes and spying on the Russians, all sorts of things, but they was embarrassed that they had to come to California whenever they wanted to do something psychic. So they asked us to set up a similar group of psychics. This is not the men who stare at goats. This is something different. But this is a group of psychics that we set up at Fort Meade in Maryland, where we were asked to interview 30 men and women and choose six of them that we would like to work with. And then those six people came to work with us for a week, one at a time, and we would show them how to do remote viewing. And this group of people did very, very well, surprisingly well. And I'll show you some of their slides. And I spent the better part of a decade sitting in the dark, interviewing people so that they and assisting them to describe where another person is hiding. Our stock and trade, the easiest experiment we could do is have me in the laboratory with the psychic of the day, and our lab director, or a colonel, or the CIA people, or the undersecretary of defense would go and hide someplace in the San Francisco Bay Area. And then I would ask the person I'm sitting with, who might be a high government official, close your eyes and tell me what you're experiencing with regard to where Colonel Watt has gone to hide. I have no idea where it is at all. I can't help you, but I can guide you in quieting your mind and doing that. And we did that very successfully. and published our findings in Nature magazine and in the Proceedings of the Institute of Electrical Engineers and American AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science. So we were publishing our psychic findings in the most prestigious journals in the world. So we had a quite reliable activity. And I came to understand that this was really a very unusual situation, because what I realized is that I was having my spiritual guidance paid for by the CIA. Because what became clear to me is that these people couldn't simply be meat and potatoes that I was looking at, because I and they had awareness and direct experience that transcended where we were sitting. Their awareness had nothing to do with a little laboratory where we were sitting. They were able to quiet their mind and describe and experience what's happening out in the distance and even in the future. And I was aware from my reading as a Buddhist that this was part of the lore. This is expected. At least 1,200 years ago it was expected. It's not so much anymore. But it was understood and taught that you're not just what they call conditioned awareness. Conditioned awareness is what you read in the newspaper, see on television, and God help us, what you see in the mirror when you wake up in the morning. The Buddhists are very concerned in diminishing suffering. If you think that who you are is what you see in the mirror in the morning, you're in for a lot of suffering, in my experience. And the teaching is that you can move away from this suffering by giving up your attention on the ego, to give up your attention on naming things and grasping, and move into timeless awareness. This was first enunciated in the way that I'm describing by the great Buddhist teacher Padmasambhava, who's a historical character, who's a guru, dharma master, who moved from India to Tibet to teach Buddhism in Tibet. He was invited to help end the wars in Tibet. So he is known for having invented Tibetan Buddhism. Without Padmasambhava, there would be no Tibetan Buddhism. It would all be Indian and Chinese and Japanese. But he brought Buddhism to Tibet, wrote numerous books, and he wrote a book that sounds a lot like other books that I've written. He wrote a book which is considered very important. It's called Self-Liberation Through Seeing with Naked Awareness. That if you don't like what you see in the mirror in the morning, you should give up the idea that that's who you are and become comfortable through your meditation with the idea that who you are is timeless awareness. That is, who you are is awareness that transcends time, transcends space, and is probably eternal. Now, I'm going to try very hard not to tell you anything about my theology or how ESP works. I'm going to try and tell you what's observable. What's observable is if you see, Buddhism is not really a religion in a certain sense. I know many Buddhists would disagree with that, but my opinion is that Buddhism is a way of thought. It's a philosophy, it's an ontology to move from suffering to a state of not suffering. Most people think that's a good idea. And they don't require you to believe anything. There's no belief system. You don't have to say your prayers. You just have to learn a variety of things to change your mind, to move from focusing on the story of who you are to a broader, more spacious expanse. Most people think that feels pretty good. And I'm sure all of the people in this room are experienced meditators. And I could say, well, why do you meditate? Why would you do that? And the answer in general is, it feels good. I'm not a stupid person. I wouldn't do it if it didn't feel good. I meditate because it's healthy, it's good for me, and I like it. Not so hard. It does not require you to believe anything in order to become a meditator. And this has been taught. The first person that I know of who wrote about the idea of seeing the distance is the great Hindu teacher, Patanjali, who before the time of Christ wrote a book called the, which is known as the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali. And as an author, it always makes me happy. Patanjali wrote this about 100 years before Christ and is still in print. So every author is very happy to know somebody can write a book and it stays in print for 2,000 years if it's a good book. And he is the one who said you have to learn to quiet your mind, and he gives lessons in mind quieting, and then you can see into the distance, see into the future, heal the sick, and diagnose illness. And that's all spelled out in his book, which is now available, called How to Know God, which is not at all what he would have called the book. But that's the current version, and is available for about $12 on Amazon, Secret of the Universe by Patanjali. The first Buddhist book, the book called The Flower Ornament Scripture, the big 1,500-page book that tells you in detail about the things that are available to the quiet mind. And they talk about these as super knowledge that's available, the super knowledge of seeing the distance, seeing the future, talking to the deceased, healing the sick, diagnosing illnesses, and numerous other things. But that's a book about stuff that happens, rays, jewels, psychic abilities. Difficult book if you're looking for a science book. Patanjali's book is a science book. He says, do this and this is what's going to happen. Flower Ornament Scripture is a book of funny things I've seen on the way to Mount Nuru. And they describe 10 different super abilities that are available to the quiet mind. 800 years later, Patanjali wrote this wonderful little book, Self-Liberation Through Seeing with Naked Awareness, which is a how-to book, how to quiet your mind and move from suffering to timeless awareness. The Answer book was written 600 years later by a great Buddhist teacher named Longchampa, Longchen Rabjan. His friends call him Longchampa. And he wrote a number of books that sound like physics texts. And the principal one, from my point of view, is called The Basic Space of Phenomena. Does not sound like a spiritual guidebook. And what he's telling us is that our consciousness transcends space and time. And it's a very interesting little puzzle. I'll leave you with the puzzle that he said. He says we're never going to understand consciousness because it's obvious that consciousness is outside of time because people can see the future. So if you have a dream tonight about an elephant walking through the garden here, there's never been known an elephant walking through the garden, but you have a dream tonight about an elephant walking through the garden, and then tomorrow at breakfast you see the elephant in the garden, how do you make sense out of that? Well, what you say is that Tuesday's elephant was the cause of Monday night's dream. So you say the future is affecting the earlier time. And it's called retrocausality. And retrocausality is now coming to the fore in modern physics. We've had two physics conferences in the physics department at University of California dealing with retrocausality. A few ESP researchers were there, but it's principally a physics issue. And the quantum mechanics, there's an open question now as to in what kind of circumstance do you have the future affecting an earlier event. Now, physicists are very happy with the idea that force equals mass times acceleration. The idea the harder you push a little wagon, the faster it will go. But the unspoken part of that is you would like it to go after you push it, not before you push it. So that's retrocausality. So if you have a dream tonight, you see this elephant trampling the flowers, and then tomorrow the elephant appears, you have an unusual situation say, yes, tomorrow's elephant probably did have something to do with your dream, but we're all uncomfortable with the idea that the elephant in the future was the cause of the dream at an earlier time. However, the evidence for that is overwhelming. So the most interesting thing I can tell you about this is that there is very strong evidence that it's no harder to describe something in Soviet Siberia, 10,000 miles away, than it is to describe something in Chicago or across the street. Increasing the distance from where you are does not interfere with psychic functioning, does not interfere with the reality, with the reliability, or the accuracy. And there's lots and lots of data that agrees with that. And the other more interesting thing that we know is that it's no harder to look hours, days, or weeks in the future than it is to describe something contemporaneous. That is, we've done many experiments where we say, where's Joe hiding? Joe's in his hiding place, what does it look like? Or we can say, an hour from now, Joe is going to give travel instructions, he's going to go hide somewhere. We'd like you to describe now what it looks like where he'll be an hour from now. That works exactly as well as the contemporaneous experiments. And our friend at Princeton, Robert John, has just published a paper showing the concatenation of 360 remote viewing experiments over several years, which are a highly significant success describing where people are hiding. We like the psychic hide and go seek experiment because that works very, very well. It has a number of ingredients of interest, good pictorial data. So in his 360 experiments, the significance is like 1 in 10 billion. Very super highly significant. And the data show absolutely that there is no evidence for a fall off in reliability as you look further and further away. No fall off in reliability as you look further and further in time up to about a month, which is as far as he went. Because people lose interest in experiments that don't give feedback after a month. I'm not saying that the experiment failed if you look past a month. It's just that we recognize that the person doing the psychic functioning wants to get feedback, and if they have to wait more than a month, they don't like it. They don't get closure. Now, what I've been describing is inflowing information. It's like transcendent knowing. There's also transcendent doing, where you can outflow your intention, outflow your psychic ability. And there's a lot of interest at NIH and other places in the ability of a healer, whether it be Reiki or energy healer or some other discipline, to ease the pain or heal illness. And my daughter Elizabeth Targ, who is a psychiatrist, did an early, highly successful experiment like this, where she had, in her experiment that she published, she had 60 AIDS patients in San Francisco. This is in 2000. And she divided them in two groups. One group of 30 had a number of people praying for them or sending energy all over the country. So you had these 30 people with 20 healers, Reiki healers, Christian healers, Barbara Brennan energy healers. And it turned out after 12 weeks in a double-blind study that the individual patients didn't know that they were in the healing group, and neither did Elizabeth. But it turned out that the 30 people who received the healing energy had much better outcomes. They were psychologically healthier, fewer trips to the hospital, fewer days in the hospital, in every way were more significantly well than the people for whom no prayers were said. So this is a very strong experiment, and it's unusual to get highly significant outcome with only 60 people in the group. Subsequent experiments were done with hundreds and hundreds of people in the group, and those were also significant, published in major medical journals. So the idea that you can inflow information and understand what's going on in the distance and in the future, you can also outflow your healing intentions. And in addition, you can experience and be in the psychic realm. So you can inflow the information, you can outflow the healing intention, and you can reside in this timeless awareness. And those are all available to you as a way of manifesting transcendent knowing. Now let me show, this is not metaphysics. This is all published data. The data about people with AIDS and heart disease for whom prayers were said, all published in good journals. And in my book, The Reality of ESP, I have a chapter describing this and describe who the people were. So let me show you some slides describing what we did at SRI, Stanford Research Institute. So I'm talking principally, let me get out of your way here. And if you want to communicate with me, my website is espresearch.com. What else could it be? Let's see, can we dim the lights a bit? So the principal cast of characters here, I don't know why I did this. I think that people like to look at pictures of people. I'll show you the team here. This is Hal Puthoff is on the left. He and I started the program. We are both laser physicists. Connection between ESP and laser physics is unknown. The guy with sunglasses is Kit Green. He's our CIA operative, of course. The guy in the blue sweater is me 40 short years ago. And the man in the funny hat is Pat Price, the psychic policeman. And we had just gone for a ride in a glider to see if Pat Price would be able to be psychic while flying around in a glider. And of course, the glider didn't interfere with his psychic ability at all, though none of us liked the noise. We had the mistaken idea that soaring in a glider is a peaceful, quiet activity. Any of you think that flying in a glider, it's not. It's extremely noisy. And you have to have noise-canceling earphones or you can't talk to each other or do anything. Big surprise. So what I'm claiming is that the evidence is now statistically so strong it'd be unreasonable to deny it. And the conclusion, which I'll give at the end of this talk, is that the strength of the data, the effect size for the remote viewing at SRI and elsewhere, is 10 times stronger than the effect size showing that aspirin prevents heart attacks. An experiment was done by the NIH 2 decades ago with thousands of people, and they showed conclusively that aspirin prevents heart attacks. And it was such a strong experiment that they stopped in the middle of it because they didn't want to expose men in the program to heart attacks unnecessarily. It would be unethical to do this. They stopped the experiment. The effect size in that experiment done by the NIH was only 1/10 as strong as the effect size in the ESP work that we've published. So we're 10 times stronger than the heart attack experiment. Now, here's the beginning of my interest in the Theosophical Society. Dora Kunz knew that I was a scientist and interested in that kind of thing. And it's a society in New York that a vast library, including the earliest records of the occult chemistry, which I can see from here is... No, I can't either. You can probably see it.
Number 5. Number five.
Alkylchemistry by Annie Besant. But I look what, and in this, she and Charles Leadbeater. I had to go to the New York Public Library to find this. It doesn't exist anymore at the Theosophical Society. And the New York Public Library went to their archives and got this for me so I could photograph this earliest 1895 copy of Annie Besant's Occult Chemistry. And what she said is that if I sit and quietly look at a block of paraffin, which has is composed of paraffin molecule is hydrogen 50 plus carbon 25, so a super rich source of hydrogen. And she said, if I look at a carbon molecule, you've got two protons which are made up of each having a triangular form with something in the corner, which she called a fundamental atomic unit. And today, we would call something like that. So this is a proton made up of three quarks, which looks suspiciously like what Annie Besant drew a century earlier. There were hardly even a periodic table, but she was able to show that a hydrogen atom has two protons, and a proton is made up of three quarks connected energetically. And in a better photograph, you can see that each quark itself has three subsections. When modern physics is coming to the conclusion, it's too advanced for this, because this is Wikipedia, which you can hardly trust for anything. But indeed, this is a contemporary, everybody agrees, not just Wikipedia, that this is the current view of what a hydrogen atom looks like. And it's really startling to see this drawing compared with what she did 100 years earlier, 100 years before. So here's our team. This is Pat Price, a psychic policeman, working with an ESP teaching machine, which I designed years earlier. But the really good news is that this ESP teaching machine is now available as a free Apple app. So I rewrote the ESP teaching machine as a game now called ESP Trainer, and each of you can download that for your iPhone and annoy your neighbors because it rings when you get a hit. And time out. I'm not selling anything here because it's a free game. So here's a mosque, and it rings the bell when you get a hit. You're going to have that as my gift. And what you want to do is guess or learn what it feels. The idea of the ESP teaching machine is you get to learn what it feels like at those times when you're going to choose the right answer. So there's four buttons here. The machine has chosen a button, chosen a picture. You want to put your finger on the button corresponding to the picture that will light up. And people can learn to do that. So I had a NASA program for a year, and we found many, many people could improve their score with the ESP teaching machine. And no one got worse. So that's a significant thing. Out of 150 people, more than a dozen got significantly better, and no one got worse. So you can indeed, with this little ESP trainer, improve at least one aspect of your psychic ability, and that's a gift.
Do you have it on Android operating system?
Say again?
Is it on Android operating system?
Only for the iPhone.
Oh. No, it's on Android.
Say again?
It's on Android. At least something called ESP trainer is on Android.
We'll have to talk about it. It's not mine. Or somebody may have copied it. So that's very interesting. I did not know that. So the man on the left is Bob Monroe, who wrote many books on out-of-body experiences, and he created the Monroe Institute, which still exists. helping people to have out-of-body experiences and learn remote viewing. Remote viewing and out-of-body experience reside on a continuum. At SRI, the two of us physicists running this program did not want anybody to have a bad experience. I didn't want anyone to go to the management and say, I'm sitting with Targ in the dark here and he separated my consciousness from my body and I can't get back together. That would have been the end of the program. With experienced viewers, it becomes clear that you can surrender more and more of your emotionality, sensitivity, sexuality, whatever you're comfortable with, and surrender that to have a more involving interaction at the distance. So we were once asked to describe Brezhnev's office in the Kremlin. I was working with Hella Hammett, who's a very gifted psychic, brought in as a control, turned out to be the most significant psychic we ever had in the program. So there for the CIA. He said, well, why don't you get a regular person? The regular person did even better than Superman. And once a year, we were given a task to remind the CIA that the ESP still exists. And Hella and I sat down, and I said, the target today is Brezhnev's office in the Kremlin. She said, I have no idea. And I said, well, let's go there. And she said, well, I'm walking down a corridor. At the end of the corridor, I see a red door. It's leather, and this red leather door is covered with brass upholstery tacks, and it's oval at the top. That's what I get. And I say, they're not going to like that. We have to go inside. So my job as a kind of psychic travel agent is to make sure that the viewer actually gets to the destination. So I say, okay, I'll push the door open. Let's see what's inside. And she said, well, it's dark. I said, oh, okay, I'll turn on the lights. There's plenty of light now. Let's look around. What do you see? And she said, oh, there's a big desk on the right covered with glass. And on the left, I can see windows seem to be looking out on Red Square. And we continued that adventure. We saw a door behind his desk, and we opened that door, and then we scared ourselves. And that was the end of that. But it was a case where we really did that together, and she made quite an investment in following my instructions, opening, going here, going there. So it's more than what do you see on your mental screen. It's let's get to the target, let's open the door, let's see what's there. So it's a kind of continuum from remote viewing, which is what do you see on your mental television screen, and nobody ever got frightened or had a bad experience, to let's get to that distant place, let's interact with that distant person, in which you do have the potential for scaring yourself. So that's Mr. Out-of-Body on the left. And we often talk together, a very thoughtful man. One of the early experiments we did with Pat Price, this is the typical best ever kind of experiments. This was the first trial we did with Price. Kit Green and Hal Puthoff went to hide somewhere. So again, here we are, first trial we did. I tell Pat that Hal and Kit Green have gone to hide somewhere. I have no idea where it could possibly be. What do you see? And he said, I see a rectangular body of water and a circular body of water and a little brick house. It looks like a water purification plant. And I see two water tanks on the right. And all of this is what he drew on the right. An hour later, they came back. We went to the swimming pool place where they were hiding. And indeed, there's a swimming pool, 110 feet in diameter. He said it was 100 feet. The rectangular pool was also the right size. But of course, there's no water tanks there. And we decided that because he thought it was a water purification plant, he made up the water tank. And we'd call that analytical overlay. Memory and imagination bring noise to the target. The secret of remote viewing is that you have to learn to separate your psychic signal from the mental noise, which is memory and imagination and guessing and naming. So that was our story up until 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we celebrated the centenary of the city of Palo Alto, and they sent us a picture book of what things used to look like. Now all the psychic people here know what the answer is. 75 years ago, Rinconada Swimming Pool was a water purification plant, and the tallest thing at the swimming pool, were the two water tanks that I show at the top. So what it appears is that Price went 5 miles south of Middlefield Road and 75 years back down the timeline to describe what was there. And no one in our community knew anything about these water tanks that were long gone before any of us were ever alive. But this is the kind of accuracy and resolution that we've come to expect from a good remote viewer. So we did 9 trials with Price. In 7 out of them, the judge guessed the correct one and put it in first place. So another way of putting that is that I'm always a stay-at-home person in the dark because I don't drive. That's how I got my spiritual training, just sitting in the dark, doing this with people for a decade. So Hal was kidnapped, as it were, 9 days in a row. On 7 out of those days, the judge would have found him first place they looked. And the significance of that is 3 in 100,000. The CIA then got very interested and said, can you tell us something we don't know, something of operational interest? And they gave us the geographical coordinates of this big R&D plant shown in the top, which is a photograph of the weapons factory in Soviet Siberia. Price drew the little crane shown in the lower right. And he said, I'm lying on this building and a derrick is rolling over my body. And the picture of the crane, a blow up of the crane from above is shown on the lower left. So CIA was extremely excited. This is the most accurate psychic thing, not only that they'd ever seen, but that they could imagine. So they said, okay, it looks like you're looking at the right place. And this is the basis of our support for the next decade. This was a sufficiently large size miracle to get everybody's attention. He said, well, what's in the building? And these are semi-palatine details seen by Price in June of 1974. He sees this large gore-shaped thing made of steel, 60 feet in diameter. In 1977, Aviation Week published the same words, 60-foot gore, and Congress said no leak was possible. This was such a, you've heard the expression, no good deed goes unpunished. This was such a good result that it was the cause of a congressional investigation of our program, because Congress, the House Intelligence Committee, so-called Intelligence Committee, wanted to find out if there was some kind of leak, because they also didn't like the idea that the only people who knew about this big sphere project were psychics in California. They said there must have been a leak. And of course, no leak was found. They told us, press on. We then did a series of experiments where Hal Puthoff traveled through Colombia and South America, the business and pleasure trip. And each day, Pat Price and I would go into our little shielded room and describe what it looked like where Hal was. And of course, Price is a psychic here, and he would say, I see a church, or I see a marketplace, I see a harbor, I see a volcano. And then on day number 5, Price didn't show up. So I'm sitting in our little, this is like a phone booth covered with wire, with copper wire, the shielded room to keep out electromagnetic radiation and crooks who would want to send our psychic information. So on day five, Price didn't show up, and I still don't know why he didn't show up. But in the spirit that the show must go on, I said, I'll do it. So I said, this is Russ Targ. This is trial five. Hal Pot office somewhere in South America. What I see is a airport on an island. There's sand and grass on the right, and I see an airport building on the left, and there's ocean at the end of the runway. So this is my first ever remote viewing on the bottom. And Hal came back with a photograph at the top, and I thought that was pretty good for an amateur. And a few months ago, I was talking to a South American cab driver who often takes me to the airport, and he said, well, I know about that place. I used to live there, and just sitting in the cab, he sent me a picture of what I was looking at. So you see ocean is at both ends of the runway. There's the runway running top to bottom, and then an airport building at the left. So this is really very good. This is my first result, and what it shows is that remote viewing is so easy that even a scientist can do it. So by 1976, I finally escaped from my shielded room, and I got to travel. And the first place I went to was New Orleans. I was visiting another, a friend who became a remote viewer with us. And to choose a target, I just bought a picture book from New Orleans and threw a die on the pavement. And the die led me to the New Orleans Superdome, which I show at the top. And unfortunately, as I stood at the Superdome, I said into my little tape recorder, this is Russ Targ, it's noon. I'm at the New Orleans Superdome, which looks like nothing so much as a flying saucer shining in the noonday sun. Bad idea. My friend, another physicist, Gary Langford, is in the shielded room with Elizabeth Rauscher, another physicist. Elizabeth is saying, okay, it's noon now, can you describe where Russell is? And Gary said, well, my eyes are closed, all I see is this damn UFO. Do you think Russell, do you think Russell's been abducted? And Elizabeth says, just draw what you see. None of us know the answer, just draw what you see. And our finding is that if you draw what you see, everything turns out all right. So Hella Hammond was a good friend of mine from New York in the early days before ESP. And eventually she moved to California. She's a Life magazine photographer. And the CIA said, can't you find somebody to work in this program who's not a famous psychic? We got Ingo Swann, who taught us all to do remote viewing. Pat Price, a lifetime psychic with the police. Can't you find an ordinary person? And Hella, of course, is far from an ordinary person. She's multilingual, brilliant, successful artist. But she thought it would be very entertaining, and had never done anything like this. And she thought it would be very entertaining to come to San Francisco to hang out with me and my wife and be paid to be a psychic at SRI. What could be more fun than that? It turned out that Hella was, and this is Hella on the right with Ingo Swann. Ingo Swann is a lifetime famous psychic, and they became very competitive as it became clear that Hella almost never made an error in describing where people were hiding. So here they're loving each other. You see, Hella's situation is she doesn't need ESP. She's got a beautiful house in Beverly Hills. She's a professional photographer, highly regarded. Ingo is nothing if not a psychic. That's not really true. He's actually a wonderful artist, but his persona these days had been, I'm the greatest psychic, I'm going to teach you all how to do that. He unfortunately died last year, but he's a wonderful artist. But at this moment in space, he was the leader of the band, and this attractive young woman stole his marbles. He was not a Buddhist meditator. none of you would be upset if a super psychic. Anyway, my very first remote viewing with Hella. See, all these other people knew how to do that, but I sit down with Hella, and she said, "Okay, what do I do?" And I said, "Well, we're looking for Hal. Can you describe what it looks like where he is now, some distant place?" And on the top little sketch, she said, "I see something moving." And I said, "Let's take a break." And she said, "Well, I see a trough up in the air, but it's full of holes, so the water is leaking out." I said, "Okay, if you stood where Hal is standing, what do you see?" And he said, "If I stand where Hal is, I see squares within squares within squares." And as you can see, her drawing at the bottom is an excellent representation of where he is. And it turned out that Hella was highly successful. We did 9 trials with her. Her odds were 2 in a million, just 10 times greater than the most psychic man in the world. So a highly successful experiment. Now, very briefly, I don't have all the data here for you. Story is, we were in a kind of psychic bubble at this point. That is, everything was working surprisingly well. And all of our ESP researcher friends simply thought we were lying because nobody had ever seen such great success. The secret of our success is we were doing a kind of experiment that works, describing outdoor natural targets rather than guessing cards. That was the secret. So, but our paper was accepted for publication at the proceeding of the Engineering Society, but we knew we still had a secret that we hadn't shared with anybody, and we knew that the person who was the viewer could perfectly well describe the hiding place before the people got there, because Pat Price often would say, "Let's not wait around for them. Let me just tell you where they will be, and let's get some coffee." And that worked just fine. So Hal and I said, what are the fewest number of experimental trials we could do such that if we were all matched first place, we could publish it? Now, the idea of setting up to do an experiment in which you require everything to work perfectly is pretty silly. That would be a weak word for stupid. But we said 4 trials will be perfect. If she gets all 4 of them first place match, that'll be significant at better than 1 in 25. And for a little side experiment, that's publishable. So the first day, I was sitting with Hella, and she said, "Hal has walked into some kind of black triangular steel thing, and I hear it going squeak, squeak, squeak." An hour later, the lab director sent him to a children's park, and Hal walked into the swing set and recorded on his tape recorder, squeak, 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 just as Hella had told us an hour before it was chosen. An hour before it was chosen, she was experiencing squeak, squeak, squeak. An hour later, Hal recorded it. One other one like this. Hella said, "It looks to me like we're in a manicured garden. I see all these little trees, they're all cut in funny shapes. We've gone to a manicured garden, and there's the garden behind Stanford University Church where we were sent." So these are examples indicating to us and convincing us that the data looking into the future is just as good as contemporaneous data. The future can be known. The last one I'll show you from Hella is that instead of giving her geographical coordinates, we got the idea that maybe she memorized the globe. Isn't that what you would think? So we said, "Well, give her coordinates in binary." So I said, "Today somebody chose targets for you, Hella. The coordinates are 101001 north, 101010 west. What do you see?" And she said, "That's a very interesting pattern you just gave me. And what I see is a belly button-shaped energy expander. The target was the Berkeley Bevatron, which is a particle accelerator, 50 miles to the north. She made the drawing in the middle. The little circular area with a dot is the belly button, and the four beams coming out of it, the four rays, are the energies going to the target building. The card on the left with a drawing from the Berkeley Bevatron by their artist showing a mechanical drawing of the place. And we were very pleased at how very accurate her drawing resembled the card. And that was my story up until writing this book. And as I was describing this, I began to get worried that she was not looking. See, the Bevatron is shown at the right, in a big pile of concrete and steel, and you could be in an airplane looking at it, and you wouldn't see the picture that she drew. So my idea of what she was doing here is she was looking at her feedback that she'd see 10 minutes later. As we know that a psychic can, I could have asked her, in 10 minutes we're going to show you a good-looking card with a drawing of the building. Could you tell me what that looks like? And I think that's what she did here. So I think that we have here and in a couple of other cases a person describing not necessarily the target, but describing their feedback. And we would have to go on and do other experiments to find out if that's true. And she said, I want to make it out of clay. And this is her clay model of the Bevatron. So this is an extremely accurate drawing. There are four beam tubes going to a target building behind a shield. And the clump of clay with a hole in it is her belly button energy expander. I'm now going to end with three slides from Joe McMonagle. Remember I said that we chose six people to take part in our program? Well, the first one we worked with and is today the greatest psychic in America that we know of, Joe McMonagle. He said he drew a bunch of little figures around the edge of the plate. He drew a number of pictures around the edge of the piece of paper we were working with, and he said, there's a tall building and then there's a lower building, and he made the drawing at the bottom, and the target was the Stanford University Art Museum. So, and this is his first ever remote viewing, and he improved from this. So a decade later, he's working with my colleague Ed May, another physicist. CIA came along and said, we'd like to see something psychic, which we hear about once a year. And this time the guy said, I'm going to just drive out of here, and at 10 o'clock I'll be someplace, and at noon I'll be someplace else, and then I'll come back and I'll show you where I've been. So Joe said, I keep thinking I have a illuminator here. So I press the button to turn on the light and it doesn't work. So on the bottom, Joe says, I see a six-story building covered with glass. It's a T-shaped building covered with glass, six stories high and a row of trees. And the place they were hiding, so even though I don't have a pointer, I can get up. Here's a six-story building, T-shaped building covered with glass. And that's where that's the administration building at Lawrence Livermore. It's their own atomic bomb factory out in the California desert, and that's where the guy was hiding. And a super accurate, Joe is not only a very great remote viewer, but is a fine drawer, a fine artist, as you see. The next place he went to, the CIA guy, he went to the Altamont Windmill Farm, another 50 miles east, and Joe said, I see some foothills with poles on them that's part of a grid, something that's rotating on the top. Now, the important reason for showing this is that this is a decade after the art museum, and there is no decline effect. One of the problems in earlier remote viewing with card guessing is that people would always get worse. We don't see any decline at all. So our probability is 3 in 100,000 for the 6 selected army guys. It's highly significant. The effect size is again 10 times greater than the heart attack experiment. Here's the heart attack. The effect size here is 0.06. And even with the army guys, it's 0.6. Even the unskilled, unpsychic army recruits are 10 times greater than the heart attack experiment. And I'll conclude with answering the question, if you're so psychic, why ain't you rich? After I left SRI, I worked with a well-known psychic. We're forecasting the change in silver commodity futures. And we did that every week for 9 weeks. And so we're going up a little, up a lot, down a little, or down a lot. And we're correct all 9 times. Made $120,000. Odds of 4 in a million. It was front page of the Wall Street Journal. That's, you can't publish silver forecasting in the scientific journal. Well, that's the Wall Street Journal. But that was a highly significant experiment. Everybody had a good time. And now there's an organization called International Remote Viewing Association, which meets annually and is principally interested in ways to apply remote viewing to make money in the market, horse racing, sports, lost children, working with the police. This is not a scientific group. They're interested in how can we use remote viewing to be helpful. It's applied remote viewing. It's called IRVA, and they meet every June in Las Vegas, the appropriate place for the meet. Padmasambhava gave us the instructions 1,200 years ago. This self-liberation through seeing with naked awareness is his instruction. And I think it's not a bad idea either. And this is the book that I wrote a year ago, The Blessings of the Theosophical Society. And I want to thank you all very much.